On a balmy April day, Mackenzie, Reagan, and Stephen, three discerning minds with a shared obsession for stories, whether bound in print or projected on celluloid, joined forces to create Owls of Palace, a production company dedicated to the fine art of analysis, banter, and occasional film-related existential crises. With real lit and shelf criticism under their wings, these three have explored the highs and lows of storytelling with an impeccable eye for detail and taste. Or so they'd like you to believe. But what of the forgotten cinematic oddities that lurk in the recesses of late-night streaming services? What of the lesser fare that once graced premium cable in the hazy hours of insomnia-fueled channel surfing? The direct-to-video gems you rented on a whim when the new releases wall at Blockbuster had failed you. Surely these deserve their day, or at least their midnight, in court. This is Parliament After Dark, the periodic special episodes where your nocturnal cinephile hosts take on the weird, the wild, and the questionably watchable films of the midnight movie canon. From cult classics to hidden gems, low-budget wonders to cinematic fever dreams, no film is too obscure or outrageous for our After Dark exploration. Each episode will journey into the heart of the late-night cinematic abyss, dissecting what makes these films enduring curiosities, or perhaps just enduring mysteries. So whether you're here for the nostalgia, the camp, or the unexpected gems buried in the rubble of cinematic chaos, you're in the right place. Dim the lights, settle in, and step into the shadows of the unconventional, the bizarre, and the utterly unforgettable. Now, the parliamentarians are seated. Let the session begin.
Parliament is in session.
Parliament is in session. Welcome, welcome, everybody.
Surprising absolutely no one, we have been crazy busy this month.
Oh, I am not surprised. Our planners just kept filling up more and more. October, I think we said this in March. October and March might be the craziest months.
They are.
Of academia, which is really odd.
Yeah, unequivocally so.
Yeah.
We had the actors come from London yesterday.
Yesterday.
You and I. Florence Lauderdale Public Library.
Yes, we did public talks.
That was nice. And by the way, thank you to our three followers who did show up for that.
Yes.
I mean, more than three, but the three who actually follow us and we know listen to us, of course.
Right. Had articles due tomorrow. We're dressing up, costume competition.
Yep, Disney villains.
I'll be Ursula. I have inflatable tentacles. It's awesome.
I'll be Scar because I already have a lion costume and I'm lazy.
Naturally. We do need to introduce our newest owl. Hello, guys.
Hi. You've heard of me before, though. Hi,
yeah, guys. you've definitely heard her voice before because we're on the Lindsay Film Festival. That Lindsay. Wrap-up, yes. You were the one doing the interviews so wonderfully.
Yes, and I will be there to do it again.
Yes.
Fantastic. So
we are very proud of Reagan. She is teaching at another university, though, and we weren't going to ask her to drive 2 hours to come talk about this movie. So we have a new producer now, so we're looking forward to working with you in the future.
Hi.
Going to be there for real lit, right?
Yes.
The illustrious Mordecai.
Yes. Hello, that's me.
So, speaking of real lit, we had originally planned... Boy, we were ambitious, weren't we?
We were ambitious.
We had originally planned to do Someday We'll Tell Each Other Everything.
Yeah.
And a horror film by the end of this month.
Yes. And a difficult film.
Yeah, a German language film. We didn't get to either one of those. But my favorite holiday is Halloween. I know you're fond of it.
Yes.
It's your favorite?
It's not my favorite holiday, but I love to dress up, so.
Okay, there's that. What about you, Mordecai?
Oh, I love dressing up, and I have to be with friends. If I'm not with friends, I'm just chilling and watching movies for the whole day, so.
Valid as well, but yes, we love Halloween. We did, of course, The Woman in Black book and film combo last year. Shelf Criticism had a whole run of Halloween films that month.
Yep. And we just gave talks over horror cinema, so.
Yeah, well, I was just throwing those into, shamelessly plug. Go back and listen to those if you really got a horror movie fix and you want to get your Halloween fix. Of course, for me, I start celebrating Halloween on November 1st. Every day's Halloween.
Sure.
But we did decide, because once before we did Parliament After Dark, if you'll remember, speaking of shameless plugs, we covered Zizek Road, the lowest grossing domestic box office of all time.
And it was bad.
It was a bad film. But we decided to do kind of a similar thing, to pick a midnight movie that is a horror film and excoriate it or praise it or what. I don't know what we're going to do. But
it's also not good.
We will talk about it. So released in 1982, The Slumber Party Massacre is a lean, low-budget slasher that clocks in at just 76 minutes, proof that Roger Corman never believed in wasting film or foreplay. The story is simple enough to fit on a VHS box. A group of high school girls plan a slumber party while an escape killer with a power drill stalks their quiet Los Angeles suburb. What begins as a night of pizza, gossip, and questionable wardrobe choices quickly spirals into a blood-soaked siege.
The film was shot over just a few weeks on a shoestring budget. While it looks like a standard entry in the post-Halloween slasher wave, its strange tonal mix, part parody, part straight horror, earned it a very strong cult following. And I believe it is essential for everyone to understand that this is a parody film. I didn't know that at first, and so it had very little depth for me, not a movie I typically want to watch, but the fact that it's a parody gives it depth. It's a movie that delivers exactly what its title promises, yet somehow manages to feel weirder, funnier, and just a little smarter than it has any right to.
So yes, it's a cult slasher, but what if I told you it began as feminist satire?
And I love it. I love it. That's right. When Steven told me that, I was like, okay, I will watch this film. Right? The screenplay was penned by Rita Mae Brown, feminist icon, as a parody of other slasher films, originally titled Sleepless Nights. Honestly, though, the new title is definitely more satirical and much more clearly a parody about the slumber party plot epidemic of the 80s. So even though Slumber Party Massacre comes off as a silly, potentially sexist title, if you know it's a parody, it makes better sense.
And then New World Pictures, which is Roger Corman's production company, bought the rights to the film. Yes, that Roger Corman, the one who produced almost 500 titles in his time, some of them with names like Naked Angels, Scream of the Demon Lover, Night of the Cobra Woman, Chopping Mall, Sorority House Massacre, Stripped to Kill 2, Live Girls. He had such oddly specific penchants as well. Like, he loves films about nurses. He did The Student Nurses, Private Duty Nurses, Night Call Nurses, The Young Nurses, Candy Stripe Nurses, and don't even get started on women in prison flicks. The Big Dollhouse, Women in Cages, The Hot Box, The Big Bust Out, The Big Birdcage, The Arena, Caged Heat, Jackson County Jail, Caged Heat 3000. There are plenty more, but I'm tapping out. I share all that not to show off my nearly encyclopedic knowledge of Corman's oeuvre. Okay, some of it for that reason. I'm embarrassed to say how many of his 493 films I have seen. Probably like 487. But I do want to stress how strange this pairing actually is. And that's not to say Corman is an irredeemable chauvinist who bathes his productions in the male gaze, although he totally does. Not to say he's not sensitive about gender politics. Many exploitation films, not just from him, but many often tackle societal issues amid their copious staging of TNA. In fact, there's nothing to suggest he didn't understand it was meant to be parodical.
He did give the task of directing to another woman, Amy Holden Jones. It was her first time behind the camera, and she only has three other directing credits to her name. She's a prolific screenwriter, penning titles as diverse as Mystic Pizza, the 1994 remake of The Getaway.
No, she didn't. I refuse to acknowledge that blasphemy exists. The first one was Steve McQueen. Steve frickin' McQueen. You don't remake that.
Well, despite Steven's denial, she did write the script for The Getaway, as well as, believe it or not, all the Beethoven movies. From a coming-of-age tale to a heist film to oversized canine shenanigans.
You can't say she doesn't have range.
That's absolutely true. Jones felt as though it played better if it were filmed straight, though it's pretty clear she, too, was in on the joke. What we got, therefore, is a strange tension between screenplay and presentation.
And since that tension exists, it ought to give us plenty of fodder for our next segment, Midnight Musings. So I'd seen this one before. It had been a long time, probably like 3 decades now. It was one of those flicks that I saw at a friend's house or on HBO or maybe snuck out of a video rental store on a VHS when my mother was looking the other way. By the way, true story. When I was a teen, even up to like 15 and 16, my mother was still policing what I watched, oppressively so. PG-13s were questionable, but R ratings were strictly forbidden. But one day, I pulled the old VHS cover swap, put a PG sleeve on an R-rated tape. When I brought it up the counter, my palms were sweating. Like, I knew I was going to get caught, and I was already primed to deny it. You know, like, it had to be somebody else. I just wanted to watch Captain Ron, not Lethal Weapon 3. Both of which are so benign. But the clerk just scanned it, paused, looked at me, and he winked. And every time I saw him after that, he'd give me a little nod from behind the counter. And honestly, sir, wherever you are, thank you from the bottom of my heart. You're part of the reason that I'm doing this show now.
So Slumber Party Massacre was basically your forbidden fruit.
Yeah, it may not have been one I saw with the old switcheroo, but I can't avow that at least partially my love for bad midnight movies come from those titles that I rented out of deception. And Slumber Party Massacre certainly falls solidly in this genre. Still, it was eons ago, enough that I remember very little. A giant drill, some pretty women, and smashing snails for some odd reason. Yeah, that part stuck with me. Like, what in the hell is up with that dude going around smashing snails at night? Like, clearly the driller killer has some mental issues, but next door neighbor needs some pretty intensive therapy too.
I think we have found the real villain.
Yeah. And this is your first time, right? First go around.
Yes. It's not a film I would initially watch, even though I do love horror films. But when you told me it was a parody of slasher films, I was like, okay, since it's an icon of the horror genre now, I will watch it. So looking at it through the lens of feminist critique, I can appreciate how this film actually calls out the tendency to objectify women in other slasher films. I did like the self-reflective moments for characters that made this more obviously a parody. Jones retains the horror elements, and the humor remains intact as subtext. Characters comment on their own situations with very ironic self-awareness, like, why doesn't anyone ever check the garage? And then one girl asks this the moment before doing exactly that thing. Right, so these meta moments signal that the film is in on the joke. It uses the formula to highlight its absurdity. The over-sexualized teen girls, the inexplicable male rage, the predictability of female death, all while refusing to let those tropes go unexamined. So after you told me that, I appreciated those moments.
Yeah, if the pizza line didn't get you, nothing will. Right. Right. Poor dead pizza guy. What is it? She's like, I can't help it. I'm hungry. I have to eat when I feel bad. Life goes on. She's like,
just leaves him.
His dead hand is literally on the pizza box, and she pulls it out from under him and starts eating the pizza.
I could not, no.
Oh, my gosh. Move on to Owl's Talons.
Owl's Talons.
Yeah, so Owl's Talons is a segment where we, as the Owls of Palace, use our talons and rip into and excoriate the film. And there's some stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like the score. Mm-hmm. I get it. It's early 80s. But my goodness, how awful is that synthy, organy, whatever is going on with that cacophony?
Not my favorite. You know, I mean, sounds do have a lot to do with horror films, though, and I almost found it humorous at some points. And this was not my favorite movie, right? I get the point of it. I get the feminist critique of typical slashers objectifying women, and I appreciate that. But the silly, silly facial expressions were just too much for me. The acting was actually good, but the dramatic angles of the camera to hyper-focus too long on certain scenes were cringy for me.
And also the number of fake jump scares. I hated this. You know, the handy woman installing the peephole in Coach Jana's, is that her name? Coach Jana's door. And just kind of goes, and we think it's the killer for a second. John coming up behind Diane. Mr. Content. What a weird name, too. Mr. Content. Yeah. Content, not content. He's not a TikTok creator, but content being in the house, you know, Courtney scaring Diane outside. I could just keep going, but there was just too much. It was an overwhelming number of fake outs. One is enough, but the 15th, I was just like, come on, man. And while I'm at it with the fake jump scares, I don't know if you caught this or not. Remember the coffee pot shatters because she left it on the oven for too long?
Yes.
She goes and she picks it up and she puts her hand underneath it.
Yes.
Like if it was so hot it shattered, that's going to burn the nerves right off of your palm, woman.
I did notice that. That was a big plot hole moment for me.
Yeah, definitely an oversight.
In our next segment on Who, this is definitely more Steven, more of our cinema professional here.
Yeah, again, we just love the owl puns, don't we?
Absolutely. Any time for a pun.
Strychnine? Is that the... Strychnine, I believe, is the adjectival form of an owl. You know, like bovine is cow.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Well, I do study animal attacks, right? Yeah, so on Who, we look for someone who may have hit it big later, someone in the background, maybe a bit player, who you suddenly go, hey, I know who that is. Last time, of course, it was just like, oh, Katherine Heigl.
Mm-hmm.
This was right before she did Grey's Anatomy. This time around, it's going to be a little bit different. There's nobody that just, like, hit major mainstream, but, you know, being a midnight movie connoisseur like myself, I'm going to tell myself here, but if you're a person of a certain age and loved bad horror flicks, there's no way you don't know the name Brinka Stevens. So she plays Linda in this film. And this was actually one of her earlier roles, but she would go on to be well known as a scream queen. She had 260 acting credits to her name. So chances are you've seen her in something. She also has big roles in some other B movies like Sorority Babes at the Slimeball Bowl-O-Rama, which is absolutely so bad it's good. Must watch. Slave Girls from Beyond Infinity. Both of those will be well known to the midnight movie crowd. She's also been in a few blockbusters. Body Double, The Three Amigos, The Naked Gun. But get this. She is credited in those respectively as Girl in Bathroom Number 3, Actress in Silent Movie, and Brunette Girl in Shower. So clearly not major roles. And by the way, incidentally and not unrelated to her role in The Naked Gun, I just have to point out some of her other roles. Shower Girl, Girl in Hot Tub, Nude Woman in Shower, High School Shower Girl, Girl in Bathroom, Girl in Shower on TV, and naturally Angel of Death.
A very well-scrubbed, floral-scented Reaper.
Yeah. I should also mention that Val is played by Robin Rochelle Still. I don't know if it's Still or Stilla. I don't know if she's German or not. If she's German, it's Stilla. If not, it's Still. But either way, she also turns up in Sorority Babes and the Slimeball Bolorama. We really should, incidentally, cover that one day for Powder Night After Dark. That's a good one. It's way more WTF-ier than this flick, and same male gaze, far less self-awareness. But I digress. Stilla really only had two other significant roles beyond those two, Vampire Nights, American Ninja 4, Annihilation. Her final credit was in 1990 as Coat Check Girl in a single episode of Jake and the Fat Man. But sadly, after struggling to find more work, she reportedly fell into alcoholism and took her own life in 1996.
Just very sad. The pressures of Hollywood are very, very real for a lot of our actors. And since I haven't watched many slashers outside the typical films like Halloween, Friday the 13th, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies, I didn't notice many connections between characters or actors and actresses here. But I will say that I appreciated Robin Still in this film. Valerie, the character Valerie, kind of saved the plot for me at times.
She was not bad, was she?
No, I liked it.
And in Sorority Babes and the Slimeball Bolorama, she's great. Like, she is a bad girl in that one. She's a sorority head, but she plays it with some nuance, believe it or not. You know, because we got these new pledges coming in about to take her role as the queen bee, and I'm probably reading too much into a very bad horror movie about a demon trapped in a bowling trophy, but I thought she did all right in that one.
And then our cross-section that we just have to have is most hated character.
Your favorite, coming over from Real Lit.
Absolutely.
All right, clearly the killer, Russ Thorne. He's the most obvious answer. By the way, I called him Driller Killer earlier, but literally there's actually a movie, I think it's 1978, called The Driller Killer. So probably for copyright reasons, they could not say that. Anyway, Russ Thorne is the obvious answer, but just like with Real Lit, we generally try to avoid the most in-your-face. So yeah, we hate the dude who drills pizza delivery boy's eyeballs out, but for the non-murderous sorts who still inspire some disdain, I'm going to go with the two boys from the school, whom I think are called Jeff and Neil. It's hard to keep them straight because, I mean, the other male cast is what? John, Diane's boyfriend, and then the next door neighbor, whom we've already talked about, Mr. Content. But yeah, first you go harass a poor telephone utility worker woman or whatever what she's doing on the job. It's a big no-no, by the way. Don't hit on people who are at work.
Right.
And then their worst transgression is they go all Peeping Tom, not the horror film. No, they watch these girls undress from the window. Like, ick. And less egregiously, but still annoying, to prank the girls by removing all the fuses from the fuse box. Yeah, they're just not likable.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, for most hated character, it's basically every dude in the film.
They're not good people.
But I think that was kind of the point, right? Not that I agree with that, because I think, like, just how we shouldn't objectify women in films, neither should we show prejudice towards men, but there's a point to be made here in feminist critique. In this context of the movie, every male character seems to have some violent or sleazy tendency, at least. Like you said, with the dude who drills out the pizza boy's eyeballs. Like, why? Why?
I think there's a metaphor there, though.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's all about the male gaze and stuff. Yeah, I do think that's deliberate.
And I do think there's a distinction there between man and boy. You know, like, villain destroying the innocent, in a sense, maybe here. But the killer, Russ Thorne, is absolutely the obvious choice. But he really does totally stink.
He does stink. Can we also talk about, though, how there's not a mean girl, per se, out of the group? Like, you know, it's stereotypical. Any film that gives us a female peer group, there's always that mean girl, right? The closest we get is, you know, Diane. She doesn't want to invite Valerie, who's the new girl, to the party. And I get that she wants it to be the old gang that they're used to. And Valerie, of course, outplayed her in that basketball scene, which is probably the real reason. But did you catch her rationale? She drinks too much milk and wears too much eyeliner. Like, that's not nice, but that's hardly Regina George. And I think that's probably part of the screenplay of Brown coming through as well, right? That we don't have that stereotypical mean girl character. It's a lot of female camaraderie, right?
Yeah. I think so. And I'm going to touch on that a little bit later, too, in depth, because I appreciated that part of this film.
We'll move into our next segment, also coming over from Real Lit.
Mm-hmm.
The WTF moment. I'm so glad I get to rant about this. Can we talk about the basketball at the beginning?
Yes.
Like, I get the sense, I don't know, it's unclear, but it seems like this is not just like a random period of PE, that they're the actual girls' basketball team at this high school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a huge WNBA fan, as y'all know, and I know we're not going to get a Liberty versus Lynx game breakout on the court, but it is so clear that none of these women ever dribbled a basketball in their lives. I mean, I wonder if they ever even saw one. The dribbling was loose, the passes were horrendous, and those girls traveled worse than Anthony Bourdain.
Okay. See, you totally took my moment, because I was also very confused. Maybe it was another feminist commentary on a sport that was extremely male-dominated in the 80s, but then you would think they'd help them to look better at it.
I wish.
Because it's kind of like dance films when you know certain people aren't dancers, right? I'm not sure. But also, when the girl is shoved in the van near the very beginning and those two dude friends are walking away, noticing nothing,
yeah,
I was like, they are literally 3 feet away from the van when she is snatched.
And did you notice, too, when they're leaving the school and they're walking away and we see her body in the dumpster?
Yes.
Like, I love that overhead shot where she's in the dumpster, because it doesn't really accentuate it. If you're not looking, you're going to miss it, but you kind of look over and you go, oh. But then they turn and they zoom in on it. And I'm like, oh, you shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
I liked it more subtle.
Yeah.
But then again, this film's about as subtle as an air horn 2 feet from your ear. So, next segment is Al's Perch. This is where we actually find something intelligent and good to say about really bad films.
Yes. Academics.
Oh, boy. Yeah, you want me to start, huh? Here I go again. I don't know why I'm always talking about nudity. I swear it's not something I sit around obsessing over. But it comes up nearly every film I discuss on here. But for this one, of course, we really do have to talk about it, right? Like we said, Brown wanted a parody of a slasher, and I think Holden Jones clearly understood that. However, we know that Corman had specific rules for all his films. There's like the four famous rules, right? You have to deliver on the title. So when he gives us Moonshine County Express, it's not random. There better be some people running moonshine. No wasted dialogue. Every word either sets up a gag or moves the plot along. Either action or comedy every few minutes to keep the audience's attention. And speaking of keeping the audience's attention, his other rule, nudity early and often. I've heard variations on this, some skin every 10 minutes, or at least 5 pair of breasts by the end of the first act. Whatever the case, it's hard to find a Corman vehicle that doesn't have a little bit of prurient content. I'm not sure if Holden Jones wanted to place that in this film or not, but she did come to Corman and ask him specifically to greenlight it, so she would have been aware of his rules. But if we look at that nudity, it is at least somewhat intentional. Bear with me.
All right.
Just hear me out. Almost immediately, we see Trish get out of bed and peel off her nightgown. Remember, you catch that just like instant.
Yes.
Breasts. Right after she gets dressed, however, we're treated to that weird scene, you know, where she gets all her toys and her trinkets and she throws them in a bag, except for it's not a teddy bear, it's a dog, isn't it? Like a cute little stuffed dog. And whatever that demonic jester-looking thing was on her desk.
Oh, yeah.
It's like she didn't even see that existed, but she kept the dog, right? The stuffed dog. But everything else, she takes and she literally throws them in the garbage can. And then she says to her mother, I'm 18, I'm not a little girl anymore. So I get it, there's this motif. I may be reading too much into this. But there's a motif of like her growing into womanhood, mm-hmm. right? That's part of that. And then we get a ton of expositional dialogue in the communal showers after that basketball practice. And the camera deliberately moves from woman to woman. Sometimes it'll like dip down to show their bare rear and then come back up. The extreme close-ups fragment and objectify the women, yeah. But the camera gets so close, did you notice this? It often isolates the nudity from the face, from the actual woman, so that there's no way there's not some kind of meta-commentary there. And that scene goes on and on and on, to the point where even I, who am usually pretty insouciant about nudity, I mean, I've seen a whole lot of French cinema, I'm going, okay, that's enough. And I can almost hear Holden Jones saying, fine, Roger. You want your nudity? Here it is. Let's see how long you can stand it. And it's not sexy. It's embarrassing. And that embarrassment is the point. Speaking of which, embarrassing. Those two boys from school, you know, the ones that sit spying on them while drinking beer and gawping at them through the window. The other part, we get seamlessly gratuitous nudity. If you notice, the camera shows the women changing into their nightgowns, yeah. But it also is continually cutting back to the two boys. And they've got this look of just like utter oafishness, as if they're mesmerized by bare breasts, and while they're literally committing a misdemeanor by gazing. That undercuts any viewer who watches the scene for sheer titillation. Mm-hmm. But the real kicker, the way they're looking at that window clearly mirrors the way that we, the viewer, are ogling the TV screen, right? It's an indictment of the audience itself. Like, we are literally Jeff and Neil.
I like that analysis. And so, like Steven said earlier regarding the typical mean girl trope in friend groups, right? Across narratives, not just in cinema, but really across all narratives, I do think that this decision was intentional by Brown. The film's central group of characters, we've got Trish, Valerie, Kim, Jackie, and Diane, embody authentic senses of female friendship and autonomy, often missing from earlier slashers. Their conversations are not dominated by men or romantic subplots in particular, but by their relationships with each other. This becomes crucial as the film progresses, because survival is achieved through cooperation, not individual final girl isolation. Valerie, who's really deemed the outsider next door, ultimately saves her peers, symbolically bridging female differences rather than reinforcing competition, which is unfortunately still a common trope among slashers. In contrast, Russ Thorne is depicted as a subpar embodiment of hyper-masculine violence. He is literalizing male aggression and sexual domination. However, rather than glorifying his violence as thrilling, the film renders it grotesque and even ridiculous. The climactic ending sequence solidifies the Slumber Party Massacre's feminist intervention. As Valerie and her sister Courtney stand over the dead killer at this point, the camera doesn't sexualize them or portray them as traumatized damsels. Instead, they appear powerful, competent, and visibly very angry. The drill lies broken beside them, a literal dismantling of the symbol of control. This ending...
Yeah, that's only the thing it's a symbol of.
Okay.
You want me to say it?
Just say it.
It's a phallic symbol. Clearly, it's a giant, like a, what is it, like a foot-long drill almost, yeah. A drill bit on that thing, but yeah.
It's ridiculous.
It is so clearly a phallic symbol.
Yep. And obviously so satirical, so exaggerated.
Oh, I love that she hits it with the machete and chops it in half towards the end, and you're like...
Right.
All right, Freud, that is castration anxiety.
And that's how you know the ending sharply contrasts with other films, right? Like Friday the 13th, where the final girl survives but remains terrified, defined by this trauma. Valerie's victory feels deliberate, suggesting that women can reclaim both agency and the narrative space from which they've historically been excluded. I can appreciate this as a female viewer because it is frustrating to watch female friendships be constantly cast in very hostile situations across cinema that almost even makes your protagonist villainous in some ways, or a complete and total victim. Also, my favorite scene might be when the girls are all huddled up together with their knives.
That's a great scene. I love that. All back to back.
I love that image.
I do have to ask you, though. Have you seen Slumber Party 2 yet?
No.
Okay. I don't think this is a spoiler because it's the way the film starts out. But we find out Valerie has been institutionalized and Courtney is clearly suffering some major PTSD.
Aww.
But, I mean, that's to be expected.
Sure.
Living through something like that, but... It does kind of remove some of that grit and toughness that you're talking about there. And yes, before you ask, that one was written by a woman too, Deborah Brock. Sorry, I crapped the carpet on that celebration, didn't I?
Well, you know, I'm going to say the fact that they can get help is a sign of strength. That's what I'm going with.
Oh, you see, we're not talking about part two. We'll have to do part two, won't we? You really want to watch another one
is
of these.
Is it bad? Is it as bad?
It's weird.
Okay.
It's like... It's almost like Nightmare on Elm Street meets a musical meets Slumber Party Massacre. They're in a band and the dude is like the killer's like a rockabilly guy with a drill bit on his guitar. But he also visits Courtney in her dreams.
Oh.
And then he shows up. I don't know what's going on with that one. It's been a while since I've seen it, but
yeah,
man, that was just crazy. So we did add another segment though.
I'm very excited about this title. Steven came up with this title.
Hoot Notes.
Hoot Notes.
It looks better written because obviously footnotes is not quite as the same as hoot. But yeah, being academics, we love to make footnotes, don't we?
Yes.
All right, I was a little surprised by the pacing. The film is only 76 minutes to begin with, but would you agree it feels longer?
Yeah, absolutely.
Particularly the first act. And like I said, Corman wanted no wasted dialogue in any of his films, everything furthering the plot. And this just seems to poop on that platitude, like I just did on the carpet. And it may be that hour and 16 runtime is already short for any feature, so they needed some padding. I thought the first kill with Linda was really well done, right? It's drawn out, but it's suspenseful. It's probably the best sequence in the film. But then the fake jump scare with Coach Janna's cat, the coffee pot breaking we just talked about, Trisha's moment of, hey, let's play the piano for no reason. Like, all that could have been cut or shortened. It added nothing to the film, and I would rather have 62 minutes of tight suspense than 76 minutes of padding.
Yeah, I agree, because it disjoints some of the film too, right? Some of the plot. And maybe I'm getting a little too academic here, okay? But I do think it's important to note that the setting of the final climactic kill scene is specifically in a domestic setting. This setting matters to me. Horror often portrays the home as a vulnerable space, right? A place where women are cornered or attacked. Here, though, Valerie reclaims it as a site of defense and control. We are used to the idea of horror taking homes and making them sites of fear, but specifically in this case, thinking about Brown and Jones as feminist authors, the setting appears much more intentional in having the kill scene of a woman killing the man predator in a domestic situation.
That is so interesting that you bring that up, right, Mordecai, who's in my my world literature course. We talk about like the Odyssey and the Trojan War and how Natalie Haynes' A Thousand Ships and Madeline Miller's Circe not only centers the female narrative, but it also it makes something like childbirth and motherhood a heroic act, an epic heroic act.
Yeah, in those stories, like comparing Homer's depiction and then Haynes and Madeline Miller's depiction of the women, it gives them like a more human character than like some side plot death, you know. It just, it adds more depth into like what's a tragedy and what's considered what, you know.
What's heroic? Yeah. Only we could bring Homer into a discussion of Slumber Party Massacre. Here's a little bit of trivia for you. The director, Holden Jones, she's not done many films. I think she's written a lot, as we said, but she's only directed like four or five. Mystic Pizza, have you mentioned it? Have you seen that film?
No, I haven't.
It's another one about camaraderie among females. Julia Roberts is in it. But she was a sound mixer before that. And she had to turn down an offer she got for a pretty big film because she was directing this. E.T.
No.
Yes. She turned that down to direct this. Which I can't blame her. This is her own direction. Right? She gets to get behind the camera here and not just mix some sound, but... Yeah, like you said, she's very well known as a writer from this point on, but not really so much as a director.
So now that I'm more knowledgeable, I look into the actual ages of actors, actresses, and the parts that they play, right? Because they're usually much older than the parts that they play.
Which, to be fair, you really don't want 18-year-olds
right.
doing what these actresses are doing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But you should at least like halfway look 18.
Yeah. You should have, and you need to have agency, for sure. But we have the ages of the actresses in this movie. We have 26, 21, 26, 23, and 24. All right, I can get those ages. But the age of the coach is 30.
Right, so the woman who's supposed to be the coach and, what, at least 10 years, if not more, right. older than them is, what?
30.
She's 30, and the youngest, or the oldest of the girls is 4 years older.
Yep.
There's a 4-year age gap between the coach and
the
supposed teenager. Yeah. Maybe she just, like, literally it's her first gig. Who knows?
Maybe.
But the thing is, she looked 30 or maybe older, but so did some of the girls.
Right.
you got to see the second one. I swear they didn't even care anymore. They're like, what, you're 50? Sure, come on, play a teenager.
Oh, my goodness. Right, and I mean, the 80s, you don't have a lot of generative editing that you can use to help.
Well, no, you definitely can't right. go in and de-age anybody.
Right. And you have to look for that now.
Yeah. Crystal Bernard is actually in the second one.
Oh.
If any of you are Wings fans, she, of course, I forgot her name. I watched Wings, but it's been so long ago. But she was in that. She also did a duet with Peter Cetera, the lead singer of Chicago. So if you ever want the like cheesiest early 90s, and yes, it was on my mixtape when I went on a date, I'm not going to lie. But yeah, Forever Tonight. Go to Spotify. Check that out.
Aww. I was trying to think of a kill scene that we could particularly analyze, but we've already talked about the first and the last one, and those are really the only good kill scenes in the film.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty awesome when they open the door and the pizza boy's eyes are drilled out.
Oh.
But the one that gets me, what is her name? The one woman of color in the whole thing. Which, by the way, 1982, I mean, bless your heart, you tried. At least they did have a woman of color. That was mm-hmm. cool. But yeah, you know, she opens the door and he just like slings it and slashes her throat.
Yeah.
Like, this is a very versatile drill.
Yeah.
It'll drill through doors. It'll drill through eyeballs.
Yeah, when I watched it drill through the door, I was like, okay, I can see how this also functions as a multifaceted weapon.
What's interesting, though, is he gets that from the telephone repair woman
right.
when he kills her. Like, that's a rough kill.
Yeah.
Because he just yanks her into the van and, like, that feels real. Everything mm-hmm. else is really cartoony, but the way he, like, starts to suffocate her and everything, that's pretty rough. But then he takes her drill. I don't know. That's...
So the fact that he takes a woman's tool to use as the weapon...
I don't know what to make of that.
I don't know.
Because it is very phallic still.
Absolutely.
And I mentioned that fake jump scare where the coach is getting her a peephole installed in her front door. And so that's a repair woman, not a repair man.
Yeah.
And she's also wielding one of those drills.
Well, and to have a repair woman in particular at the beginning is also, I think, very intentional.
That's true. Both of those are typically men jobs.
Right.
Male-oriented jobs, yeah. I do wonder why the repair woman was just randomly in her house when she wasn't home. Like, do you say I need a peephole installed and you give the repairman your keys and be like, I'll be at
plot work. Filler.
I don't know. That one bothered me. There were a couple little plot holes that yeah. really kind of got under my skin a little. Yeah.
It's a plot that also would not work if we had cell phones.
Of course not.
You know?
Well, all right, let's talk about this then. There, a friend of mine, Deborah Glass, you may know her. She writes horror as well. She uses the term TSTL. Too stupid to live.
Oh.
Like, it's the kind of person who's like, let me go investigate that noise in the basement. And yeah, she can't stand that, right? Neither can I. But here's the thing, like, it makes it seem like they can't get out of the house. Like, I get there is a killer outside. But the thing that got me is, you know, when the, I can't remember which boy it was, because they're all interchangeable anyway. But one of the boys, Neil or Jeff or whomever, you know, he's been wounded and he crawls to the back door and he's banging out, let me in. And then the guy comes and kills him.
Mm-hmm.
So you notice there's like blood rolling under the door, right? And they hear him being killed. All right, you know the killer's at the back door. Run like crazy to the front door and just, you could be three blocks away before he right. figures it out. That just bugged me. That yeah. bugged me so badly. And then at the end when it's Kim and Trish, right? They go running upstairs and they barricade themselves in her room. And it's a great shot, don't get me wrong, where they're standing there holding the knives and then you just see him crawl in the window in the back. And I get that's like a second story, I guess, and he had to crawl up some trellis or something, but close the window?
Yeah.
It just, oh, that frustrated me.
Yeah.
They were so stupid. They didn't deserve to live.
It's hard because it's one of those things where you're like, would I freeze in this moment? Or would I think to go do all these things? But when you're watching them.
I just think, you know, if you think secure the doors, you also think secure the windows, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it just struck me as a bit daft. I don't know.
Or all of you run out different doors and windows. At least one of you is going to make it.
Well, that is funny that Jeff and Neil actually say that. Well, you run this to this right. house and I run to this house. He can't get us both, which somehow he magically does. I did like that too, that like those boys were genuinely scared.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, what do we do? Like we kind of go try to have to help, right? Or do something. But they weren't like the big manly, let's go take care of this guy.
It yeah. was,
they were like, oh no.
Yeah. Maybe it's fear is a great unifier. You know, we
Maybe
all
so.
Feel it.
But you notice that, like, the men are completely useless.
Yeah.
They all get it. Even the supposed adult. Who, have we talked about the smashing of snails?
No.
Why?
It's sad.
Because, you know, dude is like, first of all, he just comes in her house while she's home alone, and he knows she's home alone. Nothing creepy about that. And then he's like, oh, I saw the door open. I was just checking on you. But then he's like... He's like, well, why'd you see the door open? He's like, well, I was out there smashing, looking for snails to smash. And you're like, that is the worst excuse I've ever heard.
It's awful. It's sad.
And then we see him actually smash a snail.
Yes.
He wasn't kidding. He just goes out and smashes snails for fun.
And I guess maybe they were just playing on that psychopath tendency to murder animals. Because that seems to be a very common trope now that you have to use. But... Why snails?
Yeah, that guy needed help, too. It was just such a weird... Let's throw that WTF, too. That's such a weird plot point.
Yeah.
Like, of all the character ticks to give him...
Yeah, it's strange. It's unsettling, and maybe that's the point, I guess, to just unsettle us. I don't know.
No, he got his.
Yeah.
All right, camera angles. Let's talk them. I thought it was well-directed.
Yeah, I was never bored. And sometimes when there's a certain angle that lasts for too long or there's no switch up, I get, you know, bored with visually watching the film. But this one I did not. I thought that there was a lot of close-ups, but that makes sense for a slasher. What you're saying with the dumpster scene, I agree. If you had left it wide shot, it's almost like, wow, this is happening and no one notices. But by focusing in, it takes, I don't know, some of the nuance away from the kill.
Well, there's a rule that you play to the lowest common denominator in the audience. So I guess yeah. they had to do it that for that reason. But no, I noticed the thing, like so many slasher flicks, we get the killer's POV. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you talked about that at the library the other day. But in some ways that makes us complicit with the killer. Like we're seeing through his eyes. You notice how much we saw this killer's face? And like, I mean, he didn't have a mask. We're always looking at him. And we didn't just get killer POV, but we also got the POV of the victims mm-hmm. quite a bit too, which I thought was very interesting.
I like that he wasn't masked because it gives this idea that it could be anyone at any time. It's not someone that has supernatural ability or a hidden physique like Michael Myers. You know, he's essentially supernatural, right? This slasher is not. It's an everyday Joe who's just walking around and decides to kill all these people one day. And that's more unsettling in a lot of ways.
Well, he'd escape from prison or an institution or something, yeah. But, yeah, that was... That guy is just, like, not your stereotypical killer. That's like Bob from Two Houses Down, who's a used car salesman, is what he looks like. He's just so plain. What about that ending? I love you.
Yeah, no.
I'm doing this out of love. Like,
it's kind of random for me.
It was kind of random. I do have a reading, and I don't think I read this. I think this is just what's popping up in my head. And, again, I read way too much into horror films anyway. So, but I do think it's about... the fear of becoming sexual, losing your virginity. Because we have that whole thing about the woman coming into womanhood earlier. And then, of course, there's obviously some Freudian stuff going on with that drill. But even the way he declares love right there at the end, that also kind of feels like it's kind of touching on some of these things as well, some of these tropes.
Yeah. I think, and maybe it's just this thought of, like, there was no romantic subplot, really. You know, and I feel like there are in a lot of horror films, slasher or no.
Yeah, Diane had John, but that was not much of a romantic subplot at all.
So maybe it was a way to have satire on that whole trope as well. Like the killer is a scorned lover or obsessed, right, with the victim. Something like that.
And this one just clearly mentally ill, I guess. And
yeah.
I mean, he does take the Barbie doll out of her trash.
Yeah.
when she's driving off, but that's about it.
Maybe that's something else they could have done with those filler minutes is character development.
I don't know. Is it? Because you get no motivation for him.
No.
Other than just he's in love with this random woman he just saw once. But obviously he's killed before. He's killed 6 people before to get him in prison. I kind of like it better that way. Not having any motivation. Just he did what he did.
Yeah.
What is it Samuel Taylor Coleridge said about Iago? We're motive hunting for the motiveless malignancy, I believe is the way you put it.
Iago is one of my favorite villains.
I do like Iago. But Iago has motivation.
Yes.
It has been said abroad that Twix
he
my sheets.
He creates motivation.
No, it's been said abroad that Twix my sheets, he's done my office, right? So we've got motivation for Iago. We don't have any for, what's his name? Tom Thorne, Russ Thorne, I believe. Yeah. Whatever his name is.
That was a great off-the-cuff Shakespeare quote.
Well, thank you.
Yep.
It's almost like I used to teach Othello every year.
Props to you.
Anything else? All right, I got one more thing I've got to address. And this is like the most 80s thing that the early 80s ever 80'd. But, and I do love this. Right when we get that scene that I was just talking about where the boys are looking through the window, they're peeping Toms, we cut to Courtney in the other house and she's looking at a Playgirl. She's even like turning the centerfold and everything. So it's really, I like that too because we got the male gaze mm-hmm. and then we turn and we have the female gaze, right? She's looking at this nudie magazine, right? That I don't know if even our listeners will even know, but you've heard of Playboy. There used to be the equivalent with dudes, Playgirl. And yeah, she's straight up looking at that. So it kind of shows like not only the men in that magazine, you know, falling under her gaze, but also like there's some agency there of like saying, hey, women have desires too.
Yeah.
And that was, believe it or not, a groundbreaking kind of thing to say in 1982.
Yeah, I think you're right in that was a more clear stance of autonomy for our female characters. And towards the beginning, I think was important to have that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's about time.
For the big question.
Should you give a hoot? So what we do here is a parliamentary decree. We're going to give it anywhere from 1 to 5 gavels. So 1 gavel would be outvoted, leave it in the archives. 2 gavels would be split decision, approach with caution. 3 gavels, a clear majority worth considering. 4 gavels, unanimously enjoyable. 5 gavels, an Owls of Palace improved masterpiece. I don't think we're ever going to get a 5 gavel.
Maybe. We might.
Maybe, but it's not this one.
It's not this one.
I'm going to go 3 gavels. We had the actors, as I mentioned before, the actors from the London stage here putting on the Tempest last week. And I was talking to one of them. And I'm not going to say his name because this may be a hot take. But he said something that I had to agree with. He said, I don't know that the Tempest is a good play. It's an interesting play, but that's not the same thing, is it? And of course, he ended it with the is it because he's British. I feel the same way about Slumber Party Massacre. You know, I mentioned before on our first episode of Parliament After Dark, we covered Zizek Road, and I gave that one 2 gavels. But it only got 2 gavels because it is the lowest grossing domestic box office of all time. You have to see the film starring Katherine Heigl that only netted $30. You just have to do it to say you did. But you'll also hate every second of it.
Right.
You should see Slumber Party Massacre just for its strange, quirky journey from the pen of a radical feminist to the production of a notorious flesh merchant. Only with this one, you're going to have some fun along the way. Maybe even have some thoughts provoked. Not much of either, mind you, but some. Enough to warrant, for me, 3 gavels.
Yeah, and I'm going to go with 2 gavels. It's not a film I would normally watch, but if you want to watch it just to say that you did, since it's become really a cult classic that's referenced in several other films, approaching it with the knowledge of the feminist background can be really beneficial. Just like when we read literature, the context can entirely transform the meaning and analysis, and that's what it did for me. If I had watched it without knowing to look for it, it would have been a 1 gavel.
I agree. Well, it probably been 2 gavel for me. But yeah, absolutely, the text, the subtext, and the history of it going from page to film all makes it patently more interesting. I still think, I mean, I like bad slashers anyway, so even without knowing that ahead of time, I probably would have enjoyed it. That's just me. But this has been really fun. It's our second time to pause and do a Parliament After Dark.
Yes.
We've got to do more.
Yeah, it's fun really to watch like something kind of silly.
It is, you know, because we're so serious sometimes on Real Lit.
Yeah.
Because our next one, right, is going to be a prestige film.
Yes.
But I love prestige, don't get me wrong. But I also love these, especially these. These are my sweet spot. Like, this was me growing up, watching Slumber Party Massacre and Sorority Babes at the Slimeball Bowlerama and Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death and all those great films that are not great. They're actually pretty bad. But yeah, it hits a streak of nostalgia. We had talked about doing Cool as Ice at one point.
Yes.
The Vanilla Ice
film. That would be so funny.
We could do it. Have a watch party.
Ice.
I've seen that movie as
You've
a kid.
Seen it.
Yeah,
oh.
Actually. I've
seen that. It was so bad.
My grandmother was obsessed with Vanilla Ice. So.
I love that.
Your grandmother.
Yes. I love that.
So. Oh my goodness. Oh, that's great. So we do need to get a little less serious, I suppose, sometimes. But yeah, we have not given up on Real Lit.
No.
It will come eventually.
Yeah. I mean, next month looks a whole lot better.
It really does, but I'm scared to say that.
Right.
Because, you know,
finals.
I'm going to jinx it if I'm not careful. But hopefully, yeah, we'll be able to get together, do the plan originally. We're sticking with that.
Yes.
The German novel, Irgendwann wir uns alles erzählen. Don't worry, we'll translate it. Someday we'll tell each other everything by Danielle Kream. And then we have the film counterpart to that. Looking forward to it. It's a metaphor.
The film Someday We'll Tell Each Other Everything. It's like a whole sentence.
It really is. It's a quote from Dostoevsky, right?
Yeah, was it? Because I was looking, I was like, wait, it means someday, someone. I was thinking in my head.
And yes, I am aware that there used to be a podcast called Shelf Criticism. I have been so busy. Like this whole semester, the end of summer, it all just got nuts. Remember I had to move offices? We complained about that.
Yeah.
You can look around. I still haven't put my office back together. And I got here in August. So I'm way behind, but I do want to start again. Arachnophobia is the next episode. I've got to do Anora because it's the greatest film ever made in the last year or two anyway. So yeah, we'll get back to it and maybe give you some more Parliament After Darks.
Yeah.
Since you've seen Cool as Ice.
Yeah. It's been forever though. So
hey, I have it. I own it on digital.
That's crazy.
That would be a fun friend watch.
We will definitely get back behind the microphone again and keep these things coming. But until then,
Parliament is no longer in session.